My brother won Husband of the Year this year.
So how did he do that?
He gave my sister-in-law tickets to this big 80s reunion tour that's going to Texas in May. But the best part of the gift is he had Debbie Gibson, who's going to be in that tour, record a video telling my sister-in-law, Jen, she was going to the concert. Here wow. it is. Now, listen to this.
Hi, Jennifer. Debbie Gibson here. Happy holidays, girl. Listen, your amazing husband, Michael, dropped by to let me know that your birthday is coming up and that you are coming to see me in concert in Dallas in May.
That was kind of cool.
It's very cool, but it got better.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday.
Okay, so how did this happen?
So, well, I know, that's what everybody said. So, of course, he said, oh, I know Debbie Gibson. Like, no, you didn't date Debbie Gibson. You don't know her. But what he did is he found this website called Cameo, and you go onto this website, and you can buy and create personalized shout-outs from celebrities. So this guy named Stephen Galanis describes it as getting a modern-day autograph from a celebrity. You write in, you say, I want to book so-and-so, and I want them to say such-and-such, and then for a slight fee, some bigger than others, you get the video then emailed to you. It's very cool. We'll talk to Stephen a little later in the show. But first, we're talking to Debbie Gibson, because in the late 80s, there was no one bigger in pop music than Debbie Gibson. She holds the record for being the youngest female artist to write, produce, and perform a number one song. She was only 17 when she did that. Her big album, second album, was called Electric Youth. It came out in 1989. And that year, she was actually recognized as Songwriter of the Year by ASCAP alongside Bruce Springsteen. Have you heard of him?
Okay, yeah. I've heard of Bruce Springsteen, but I haven't heard of Debbie Gibson.
The reason is Seattle grunge, because that came in late 80s, early 90s, and like completely wiped out people like Debbie Gibson. But this summer, all those late 80s real popular pop stars like New Kids on the Block are getting together, and they're doing something called a mixtape tour. Do you know what a mixtape is?
I do.
Oh, good. We're back on the same page.
I did have a Walkman.
Well, Debbie is also going to be celebrating the 30th anniversary of the release of Electric Youth as well on the tour. So in this Dying to Ask, we're talking about how tapping into fan experience has created great opportunities for performers like Debbie decades after they were initially famous, what her life is like these days now that she and her fan base are in their 40s. And then later in the episode, we'll meet up with Stephen Galanis, the creator of Cameo, and we'll find out how on earth did you talk all these celebrities into making videos. This is Dying to Ask. I'm Deirdre Fitzpatrick, and I am obsessed with knowing how people do things. I write the book, they start the company, they go from idea to reality. I call it the art of the follow-through, and I want to know how people go from A to B. This is the Dying to Ask podcast. Debbie Gibson, if you would have told my 80s-loving teenage self that as a grown-up adult person, I would be sitting here someday talking to Debbie Gibson, I would have said, stop the stressing, because clearly, like, my life's going to work out just fine.
You would have said, it was only in my dream.
Oh, yes, that's exactly what I would have done. Thanks for joining us. Thank you for joining us today. This is a real thrill. And as I was telling you just, you know, before we started recording the podcast, you were the hit of our Christmas dinner. You recorded this video for my brother to give with tickets to your upcoming show to my sister-in-law. And the video was like nothing I'd ever seen. You sang Only in My Dreams. You sang Happy Birthday. You told some great stories. You were sitting by the piano where you had written all of these songs as a teenager. Like, I have never seen anything like this thing.
That's so cool. You know, I like to, when I signed on to do it, I knew that I was going to go all out or just not at all.
Oh, you went all out, all right.
I like giving people a wow moment in their life because I'm a real life person. Like I'm going through a health thing with my mom right now. People are always going through something. And I think if you can come to them with some humanity and some music and again, I'm very aware of the fact that I don't think of it in an ego sense, like, hey, people love me. I think of it like I represent a time in life that for people was very pure, really fun, really innocent. And I think like me and the artists of my time take people back to that time in their life. And that's the deeper part of music and of doing a Cameo video.
Right.
I think it just connects. And look, it connects people in a way that, you know, when I was on a tour bus, I couldn't keep in touch with Tiffany. I couldn't be Instagramming my life. I could, you know, we weren't connected in that way. So to be connected in that way now, I mean, I love it because I'm a people person. So I just love it. I think Cameo is brilliant. And I was doing fan videos on my website even long before that. And it was one of those, oh my God, why didn't I think of that idea? What a brilliant idea.
That was the first thing I said when I saw it. I'm like, that is so smart. I wish I had thought of it. But now
they
I'm thinking.
It's so easy. Yeah.
I know. All the good ideas are. But now I'm thinking, imagine if you and Tiffany could have had a Twitter war of your day. How epic would that have been?
Oh my God. We wouldn't have had one. And then people would have been really disappointed. So
totally.
Maybe it's better that they live in that fantasy that we were like, who? We always say this. We're like, who had time to like hate on people? Like we were just in our thing. We were doing our touring and our music. And every time we ran into each other, we were like, how are you holding up, girl? I'm good. Okay, how are you holding up? Because we felt kind of like the only two girls, I'd say in the U.S. anyway, doing it on that scale. I mean, and there was
absolutely.
There was like Shanice, Tracy Nelson, Tracy Spencer. There were some other young artists. There were the Jets. But you know, she and I were the two girls, like I said, doing it on that pop, big pop level. And I just always rooted for her. I never understood why magazines made people choose. Mm-hmm. I was like, wait a minute, correct me if I'm wrong. You don't have to go to a record store and just buy one record.
No.
But I was always like, hey, you know, my sister and I, my younger sister Denise and I had that Sony Walkman with the splitter, the headphone splitter in it. And when you could listen to music when you were taking off on a plane, we would listen to I Think We're Alone Now every time we took off with that. And the plane was going down the runway. We did it every time. We always loved Tiffany.
Oh, that's great. You know, as I was doing research for this interview, I did a total double take when I realized that Electric Youth, which was your second album, is turning 30.
I know.
What? I could not believe that.
I know. I feel like I'm eternally in my 30s, so it does seem impossible. And I think, again, I think everyone in our generation feels that way. Like, there's a youthfulness to this generation. So, yes, it is this kind of crazy wake-up call, but it is indeed 30.
Do you think that's why there's such a huge market for 80s nostalgia right now?
I do. It's like what I was saying before. I do think people want to be taken back to their youth. But what I love about a lot of the artists that are still vital and vibrant now, like Belinda Carlisle, like New Kids, like, Tom Bailey, the Thompson Twins, like I perform mm-hmm. with these people here and there. They're all still relevant because they're not just stuck on their hits and they're not like living in some bubble. I think everybody's still very current and modern, and yet we all embrace our past and we understand that that's that magical moment. Look, we all want to have that moment again. But if I never had that moment again musically, like I plan to, but if I didn't, you know, who gets that moment once, like to make that kind of an impact? So to be able to be the person delivering those songs, and again, not just singing at people, but communing with an audience and taking them back to their first kiss, their first dance. I hear people's stories all the time about how the music was part of the fabric of their childhood. And I'm so honored that I get to be a part of that. So I do think, yes, that's why people are so nostalgic for that music in that time.
Do you think that's an 80s thing, or is that just a generational thing? You always go back to the music of your youth.
Well, you know, it's a great question. I mean, there's that hit out right now. I think it's like 2003, and it talks about Hit Me Baby One More Time.
Yeah.
Bye, bye, bye. And right. So obviously people born in 2000 or, you know, who were teenagers in 2000 and that decade have that nostalgia as well. Like my mom, you know, when she got to meet Frankie Avalon and, you know, see Jersey Boys, Frankie Valli. And like, you know, obviously she gets taken back. She goes, oh my God, I used to watch them on American Bandstand. I can't believe I'm meeting them. And it takes her back to her living room dancing to American Bandstand.
Yeah, exactly.
So I do think it is. But I do think there's something, and I'm not saying this because, like, one thing, you know, people always think they're complimenting you and they're like, they don't make music like they used to. Yes and no. Like, I listen to so much current music and I think there are brilliant artists out right now and amazing, amazing music. But I think the thing they're saying is, like, there was something unashamedly pure and melodic about the 80s music. And there was a sense of fun. It didn't take itself too seriously. Nobody was like solving world hunger with
no.
Wake me up before you go-go. But because there was a world hunger problem, you wanted to escape to Wake Me Up Before You Go-Go. And that's like, that to me is the power of that music in that time.
Your career arc is interesting because you had incredible success when you were 16, 17 years old. And then your arc of the really big success ended at around 20 when this little thing called Seattle Grunge came onto the scene and everything changed.
It is. It was definitely a whirlwind. And then when Seattle Grunge came in, I became this emoji. Shrug. I went, shrug. I'm going to go to Broadway because that's my other big dream. And so that was an amazing thing for me because I didn't feel I was a victim of pop trends. But yeah, that was a fast and furious moment for sure. And weirdly, though, it still didn't happen overnight because there was 4 years of writing and demoing in my garage. There, now I realize that's not a long time, but as a kid, that's a huge percentage of your life. So you feel like you're waiting forever for it to happen.
Right.
You're like, I'm 14. Where's my record deal?
You weren't that far off, though.
I know. And the thing is, now they're signing fetuses. But back then, they weren't signing 14-year-olds. So they didn't know what to do with me was the main thing. They're like, we like the music, but we don't know how to market a teenager. And it was like, well, let me show you. But yeah, I was always kind of like the guinea pig / pioneer. But even at that time, so the first year of my career, a lot of people don't know, I played a teen club, a straight club, and a gay club every night, 4 nights a week, for about 9 months straight to get the first single off the ground. That 9 months felt like 9 years.
How old were you at that point?
16.
Wow.
And I just was texting a friend about this the other day. My mom was only like, wait, if I do the math, I don't know. She was like, late 30s or something.
Well, Electric Youth is 30, so count back from there.
All right, there you go. Yeah, so 33. She was in her 30s.
Huh.
And she had me and two dancers and my older sister Karen on the road doing sound and lights. And we would pull up to these clubs in this like obnoxious stretch limo that they'd send for us. We actually had a hot pink one once, which was mortifying. But with this blonde driver, she had this fantastic big blonde hair and a white tuxedo on. I'll never forget it. That was in LA actually. But anyway, she would go into the club and she'd say, kids, if I'm not back in 15 minutes, someone come in and get me. She'd go into the basement of these clubs and collect the money up front from some seedy club owner. And at times it was a 6'8" drag queen. And at times it was some mafia guy. And she later said, you know, she was petrified. She didn't know what she was doing, but she knew she had to protect her daughter. She knew if she didn't get the money up front, we'd never see the money. And I just thank God that's so unparalleled. Like, talk about being a momager. Like, she broke ground at that time. She was young. She was female. I couldn't have done what she did. So that's really how my career started. And it really just snowballed from there. We then slowly got radio's attention. Then we went to every radio station in the country when it wasn't a monopoly. It's not like, hey, we got Clear Channel. No, right. It was like, you have to go shake every DJ's hand and every program director. And then maybe you'll get played.
Maybe you'll end up in a mixtape somewhere. Maybe.
Right. But my mom would like send program directors New York bagels because she knew they were from New York. I mean, she would get really creative. And to this day, I have people asking about her saying like, I'll never forget your mom sending me those bagels. And that like, it was such an amazing time because you had to really put the legwork in.
You did the work because you didn't have things like American Idol or you didn't have...
You didn't have YouTube. You didn't have a million people in a day.
Would have been great on Instagram, though. I think you would have been fantastic.
and yet, I think it would have stressed me out at that time. Like, I think back to my life, I was always anxious. And I'm always a little bit wired and anxious now. So even if I'm, like, too much social media now, I start to, like, twitch. So back then, it would have been fun, but it might have taken me down. So I'm kind of thankful I lived in that bubble.
Oh, I think it worked out okay for you. So let's take a quick break. When we come back, I want to talk to you about what's going into the planning for this mixtape tour. And then also talk a little bit on the personal side about what goes into this constant reinvention. We'll have more Dying to Ask right after this. Jeff, you know how when you plant a garden, you water it so it will grow?
In theory, yes. Mm-hmm. I've not done this myself.
Yeah, that's not how podcasts work, though. We need ratings and reviews, so please take a second when this episode finishes and leave us a quick review on Apple iTunes. I read all of them, and whoever ID'd themselves as L3SF and suggested that I slow down a little bit, you were right. So thanks for the feedback. Back to the show. So this 80s New Kids on the Block mixtape tour sounds like ridiculous. I mean, what a way to kill a summer.
Right? I know. I am so excited. I haven't done like a good old-fashioned bus tour. Like, we're on the bus every night, like after every show. It's very rock and roll. But for me, that's actually...
But what is, I was going to say, what is rock and roll when you're in your 40s, though?
Well, no, when I mean rock and roll, I mean... just the romance of getting on a bus every night. No, my dogs are coming. I have like a very small skeleton crew.
Okay.
I'm like as early to bed as possible, even on this tour. Like if we're done at 11, like I'm probably asleep by 12. So I don't know about Tiffany and Salt and Pepper and what's going to be going on that bus. And not like introvert. I'm going to be like the calm, like, I don't know. But, and the guys, you know, they're married and they have kids and right. They have dogs. And so it's a very different thing now. But what's been so much fun is Donnie Wahlberg's really the creative visionary of the group. And he and I have had a lot of communication about the creative aspect of stuff. And it's been so amazing, like getting to know him and the other guys, because there's some cool surprises, we'll say, in the works. And it's so refreshing to know that they are not part of like the teen star roadkill that has littered the streets. Like they are, I mean, and you take Donnie, he's got his acting career.
Right.
He's got his incredible woman. He's got all of this creativity and energy for the ongoing to keep the New Kids like fresh and current. And I just love it. I just think it's, again, it's just a testament to the fact that we as an entire generation don't have to rest on our laurels and just kind of be who we were. We can be who we are now. We can take people back and still move forward.
Yeah,
and
which is great, because some people don't.
The idea of the show.
Yeah, I mean, some people get stuck on something and there isn't that concept of still reinventing and doing new things. You can be respectful to a time, but still be respectful to the present as well.
Right, and look, this is going to be mainly we're doing our hits. We're not all getting out there going, here's my new single. You know, we're not doing that. It's really going to be wall-to-wall hits all night. But I think the way we all approach our lives and communicate with the audience is very modern. Like, I want to say this, which is funny. I sometimes, because I've been through all the fashion trends and I can look back on them now nostalgically, I will, like, I was on the Today Show and they had me dress like me in the 80s. So it's like, I just want people to know if I dress as an 80s homage to the time, I'm not stuck in the 80s. Like, that's what you hope people realize. It's like, no, I, much like you, will enjoy maybe busting out a retro look for that night, maybe for one of the songs, because it's fun to play with and, again, take people back in a tongue-in-cheek kind of way. But I'm not stuck there. So, yeah, it's interesting. But the planning process has been amazing. I just, can't wait to hit the road with all the acts. It's going to be a really, really incredible.
Well, and it's funny. You think about, like, a group of people who really get what you went through and experienced.
Right.
Like, that's all them in, like, three buses right there.
I know. I mean, because I remember, like, seeing their concerts and meeting them backstage as a fan, like as a peer and a fan. And I still feel like a peer and a fan. You know, like it dawned on me the other day, I heard Step by Step and I went, oh, I'm probably going to be hearing that live every night. I'm going to have like the best seat in the house to see and hear New Kids and Tiffany and Naughty and Salt and Pepper. And I wasn't as familiar with Naughty by Nature until I started doing some press with them. And I'm like, these guys are brilliant.
Oh,
like,
you're going to have a good time.
I know. I think behind every hit act, there's stuff that you don't like. There's a reason why they are a hit act. And those guys are really intelligent and really brilliant. And Salt and Pepper bring that same energy. And you forget how many hits they've had. Like, forget it. And if anyone hasn't heard Tiffany sing live lately, I mean, even when I heard her when she was a teenager, she had that big Stevie Nicks rock voice. And it's only gotten better with time. Like, I see her Instagram stuff and we're friends, but I'm always like, girl, you're feeling your vibe and it's making me so happy. Like she's out there doing it. And she used to not be a songwriter. Now she's a songwriter. And that's front and center for her. So just watching everyone evolve, I have a sense of camaraderie and pride and respect. Yeah.
Right. Right. Speaking of evolving, what do you love about being in your 40s now?
I mean, I'm approaching 50, if you can believe, but
I don't, but go on.
I don't either. It's like I say, like I'm going to 50. So one of my friend's 50th birthday parties is in, you know, like 2 weeks. And I'm like, how'd that happen? I met you when I was in my 20s.
You're like, why would you invite me? Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah, right. No, but you know, it's funny. This is what I start to do. And as my friends are turning 50, I'm going, God, 50. I wonder what that must feel like. Oh my God, I'm going to be there soon. Like I completely forget, which is good. But you know, I just think it's funny. Marie Osmond is my friend and I go to her show sometimes on the strip. It's one of the perks of living in Vegas. You can go see your friends perform.
Right.
And we had a funny conversation where I said, you know, I think I still care what people think. She was like, I don't.
Oh, I believe that. I don't think she cares.
As you get older, like you really start to not care and not care in a bad way. You just really own who you are. You know, you kind of like, I don't need to be that type A girl running a race anymore. I don't need to prove anything to anybody. I just feel like I'm me, you know. I know on the break you were bringing up some of the health stuff I've dealt with, which we can talk about. And through that process, I've gone, you know, I can do what I can do. I'm not in competition with anybody. I'm not in competition with who I was at 20.
That's a great feeling.
It is a great feeling. I pace my life very differently now.
Did getting diagnosed with Lyme disease force you to do that? Or do you think you were already on the path to that?
No, I think sometimes you have to have your back completely up against the wall of your life. And I think that the Lyme diagnosis, I've said this to people, it could have been Lyme, it could have been anything. But because it was something with a label, it definitely was a wake-up call to check in with myself. It wasn't about, for me, how do I cure myself of Lyme? It was, how did I allow this illness to take me over? What in my being is not in harmony? That's, and again, it's different for everybody. So I am always very careful because there are also people that are in harmony, are happy, are eating perfectly, are doing everything right, and they still get hit with illness.
Right.
That's the mystery of life. So I'm very careful to not say that for everybody, but for me, I felt it was a wake-up call. And I do feel like there were toxic situations around me. There were ways in which I was just pushing myself too hard. And, you know, I always prided myself on being healthy, but then I looked at myself and I went, I'm not as healthy as I'm claiming to be. And I really need to be mainly energy aware. Even now, you know, I have people like over the next 2 weeks as I'm preparing for the tour, I'm getting invites. Oh, come out to dinner. But I'm early to bed right now. Period. End of story. I know my body. I know that as I start gearing up for something, you do get anxious. You do get like, oh my God, this is coming up. And so for me, I've learned, especially at times of stress, even if it's happy stress, times of high activity or high public visibility, I need to be overly cautious with my energy, my diet, what people I'm surrounding myself with. It becomes like, oh, I need a bubble. And I think we all need that. And I think you're lucky if your life doesn't come crashing down at some point.
I think so, that is like, such great advice, whether you're, like you said, whether you're dealing with a diagnosis or if you're just trying to get through Monday. I think that is so true.
Yes, exactly. And look, you know, like when I was, my mom's dealing with a major health event that she's gone through, and I was with her in Florida, and emotionally, I needed to eat Dunkin' Donuts. Mm-hmm. I needed to drink coffee. I needed to be bonding in that way with my sisters. But I'm aware. Like, I'm aware I'm doing it. I'm aware of when it's catching up to me. I go, okay, emotionally, I need this now. Oop, physically, it's catching up. Now I need to swing it back. And again, I think everyone's like that with diet. It's never been about weight for me. It's been for me about if my energy is good. Like, yeah. I'm a blood sugar girl. Like, if I don't eat, like, every hour, I get shaky. I get, you know, foggy. And so I think it's just a matter of like being in touch with whatever works for you. I know people that go all day, they don't eat, and they feel better that way. So there's like no one size fits all for your health. But take it from me, don't wait till you're backed into a corner and you physically can't move, because that's what happened to me. And, you know, I think it's just never, I have a nephew who's like 14 and he's like, I'm rock climbing and I'm eating healthy. He goes, I just want to start now. I go, oh my God, good for you. I was eating like burgers, fries and shakes at 14.
And trying to get your money at the gay club with your mom.
Well, yeah. Well, yeah. We were hungry after a night at the clubs, girl.
Exactly.
We were like, take us to the diner. Where's the nearest diner? It was that 80s good old all-American diet that
it was all
heart
good.
Problems later in life.
Yeah,
right?
As it turns out, it does.
So
I know we need to
no more now.
I know we need to start wrapping up with you, but I wonder what for you, to me, you have really mastered that idea of being content at different stages in your life, and especially right now, and really seizing the moment. What's your best advice you would give to people about looking at where they are and really capitalizing on the opportunity that's in front of them?
Wow, that was a whole lot of information to process.
I know.
And thank you for that. I jokingly to my friends call myself Guru Gibson. Not really, but sometimes I'm like,
so lay your best stuff on us, Guru.
Wise old soul and whatever. But no, but I do like to think that I've done a lot of work on myself. One thing that the whole health moment in my life also forced me to do was just to address my crap. Like, you know what? You have to own what, you know, like, you've not always been perfect your whole life, and maybe you're not always the kindest person, like, during the course of your day, or whatever those things are, taking a good, hard look at. And then in terms of, like, seizing opportunities, I'll give you an example. Yesterday, and look, I still continue to have some symptoms. And because my mom's going through something, I'm going through stuff now because we're connected and I'm stressed. I'm emotional about it. So my body can flare up and have symptoms that are, I don't know if it's Lyme related or just life related. Like, bodies freak out when you're under stress.
Mm-hmm.
So yesterday I woke up. One of my good friends, Paul Sidoti, who plays guitar for Taylor Swift, he was in town and he offered to come do guitar in some of my new songs I'm working on. I woke up, honestly, I was tired and I was in pain. And I said, sorry, pain, we're going to the studio. That's it. Like, I was like, you know what? There's something about living your life and not, you know, you have to know when to rest and all of those things. So I declined dinner invitations last night after the studio, but I thought there is nothing that is not going to be healing about doing music today, you know? And so I think that we have like concepts in our head, and if you can break the concepts and go toward whatever your picture of happiness is, you know, I keep saying I'm going toward the happy people, the music, the foods, my dogs. And I think that when you do that, the bad stuff that's trying to take you over can't hang around for long.
Go toward the happy. That is amazing. I love it.
Might be a new song.
I think it should be.
Go toward the happy. I know. I might have to hang up and write it. I don't know what that melody was. You're not finding that melody on the album, but yeah.
Well, I have thoroughly enjoyed it.
And I just want to say one more thing.
Yeah, yeah.
There are, like, in the new music I'm writing, there are a lot of songs with that theme. There's a song called Turn It Around, and the first line is, that's fear you're feeling, sister, got no power over you, and pain is fear's mister, they walk two by two. And I sing that line to myself if sometimes I'm in some kind of panic that doesn't seem justified. I go, oh, that's just fear.
Yeah.
That has no control over you. Just let that go and keep stepping through it. So
has there ever been a day in your life where you didn't sing at least for a few seconds? Probably
no,
not.
I always say life's a musical. I think life should be a musical. I read that America Ferrera said that in an interview the other day. I read it and I went, oh my God, girl, we gotta get together.
Oh.
I think like if you can sing it, just makes everything better.
Debbie, this has been fantastic. As a total fellow Gen Xer, it's been great. Jeff, you are not a Gen Xer. Have you recognized any of the bands that Debbie and I have talked about?
One or two.
Well, there's this beautiful new invention called YouTube and Google.
Oh, yeah.
So you can go do your research later.
And he can also catch you at your mixtape tour, which is going to be going through cities this summer. Have the best time. And thank you so much for sharing a little of your wisdom from over the years, singing with us and joining us today. Really appreciate it. And thank you for that amazing video that you did for my brother, because, again, like, it was epic.
Thank you. And I'll be back on Cameo soon. Again, my life took a little detour for a moment, so I had to stop for a minute, but I will be back. I think it's such an amazing, amazing gift that they've given to all of us to connect.
It's pretty unique. It is pretty unique.
And I know you're talking to the founder.
We are. In fact, we're going to do it.
Tell them how much I love it. I mean, what's not to love?
What's not to love? Well, on that, we'll be back with Stephen Galanis right after this. Do you love politics? Well, check out The Trail. Anyone who wants to be president has to go to New Hampshire first. This is a new Hearst Television podcast from our friends at WMUR-TV in New Hampshire.
How fun.
I know. The host, Adam Sexton, interviews all the people who want to live at 1600 Pennsylvania. And the way this 2020 campaign is shaping up, Adam's got a whole lot of episodes to record. You might have to help him with that. Check out The Trail from New Hampshire to the White House, wherever you get your podcasts. Stephen Galanis, we are here today because of you and this whole Cameo ideas. Thanks for joining us. We appreciate it. Thanks for having me. Of course. Where were you when you had this idea of what if we could fill in the blank?
So crazy enough, when Martin and I had the idea, we were actually in the car leaving my grandmother's funeral.
No.
So Martin, my co-founder, was an NFL agent and movie producer. And he's a guy that repped, like, not superstar players, but picture like the 15th best player on the Seattle Seahawks defense. So people that might have been big in college, but were now just, one of 53 people on the team and not the Tom Brady's of the world. Not superstars.
But a lot of the people who do the real work.
Oh, yeah. I mean, look, there's value in them personally, but, like, the reality is, like, the Nikes of the world and the Adidas and the Under Armour aren't giving them the big contracts for off-the-field marketing. So we had this larger idea that there's this gap between fame and the ability for talent to monetize. So I'm a Duke grad, for example, and Zion Williamson, who's now going to be the top pick in the draft, he came in to Duke with 2.1 million followers on Instagram, right? And, like, you could imagine if he didn't make the NBA, like, he'd still have all these followers. He's, like, super famous now. My best friend from college is a guy named Lance Thomas, who starts for the New York Knicks. He's been in the league for 9 years. He won a national championship at Duke. He's got, like, 47,000 followers. So people are more famous today than they've ever been. Anyways, the problem that we were trying to solve with Martin's clients specifically, like, how can we create a way for talent to monetize their social in a way that's not brand negative, like actually in a brand positive way? And we had this larger idea of the selfie being the new autograph. And Martin pulled out his phone and he showed me this 10-second video of Cassius Marsh, one of his players, congratulating a guy who was pretty high up in Nike's marketing department on having a first son. So imagine this player is driving in the car, he's got no shirt on, and he goes, "Hey, Brandon, it's Cassius Marsh from the Seahawks. Heard about your son, Maverick. If he gets your athletic ability, he'll be playing for the Seahawks one day. Go Hawks."
That's right?
We saw that. We thought that was cool, but that guy put it on Instagram and said it was the best gift he ever got in his life. And that was kind of the aha moment for us. It's
right.
Like, if this person who has access to Michael Jordan and Kyrie Irving and LeBron and Kevin Durant is, like, impressed by Cassius Marsh, like, we love Cash, like, you know, he's a great guy, but, like, he's not a superstar. It's not Russell Wilson on that team. If he's that excited about it, he thinks this is the best gift. What would someone without access be able to feel if they got it? And that's when we're like, we have to build this marketplace. We need to create a marketplace where you could pay to do, you could pay X amount of money to do Y activity with Z person.
So smart. Because, like, anytime I'm at LAX, I always look for famous people because you always see somebody who's kind of trying to pretend like they won't be seen, except you know they really want to be seen. And, like, you going up to them with the phone and saying, "Hey, is there any way you could say the following?" is something that most fans want to do. So it seems brilliant. So how do you go from, you know, the backseat leaving the funeral to actually putting this out on a website and talking celebrities into doing this? And was it a hard sell?
So this is a pretty crazy story. So we literally spent the whole ride, like, stuck in traffic thinking about this. I dropped him off at O'Hare. He had flown in for the day for my funeral from LA. And immediately, right when he got through security, we got back on the phone and we started talking about it again. And bottom line, I'm like, I got to get out to LA. So I did not go back to work the next 2 days. I got on a plane to LA, and Martin and I spent the next 2 days like really thinking about this. Now, neither one of us are technical, so we needed somebody to build the website. I called on somebody named Devin Townsend, who's our third co-founder now, but was the best coder that I knew from Duke. And I'm like, Devin, you got to hear Martin and I out. I think we have this like really cool idea. And the thing that's so interesting about Devin is Devin actually was an early Vine star. So he had is a guy that had over 800 million loops on Vine. So he specifically understood what it's like to be long tail talent, like somebody that is more famous than he is rich. His roommate Cody Ko is now one of the biggest YouTubers on earth. He's also 3.6 billion loops on Vine. So Devin and Cody would like go to Coachella or they go to these things and they get like recognized by people all over the place, but they weren't making like money from it, right? So we really had conviction about this idea of the gap between fame and monetization like widening out. And we really felt that if we could create, like, obviously, like, fans would want something like this, but could we create a compelling experience for talent that made it so fun that talent would do this for free, but they get paid, right? And to Devin's credit, he built this product that people like Debbie and our $10,000 talent, they just, like, love doing. It's like a mix between Tinder and Snapchat with where they get paid to do it. It's like, yeah. It's so addicting and fun.
But nobody's swiping past you because they're paying you.
Yeah.
And it's brilliant.
Yeah. And the reason it's so fun for the talent is like, they're getting paid to become more popular. Like the value prop's amazing. Mm-hmm. Every time Debbie does one for her fans, like that fan loves Debbie more than she loved it before she got that video. And then that fan statistically is sharing it, the content out there. So if you've never heard of Debbie, you're not seeing it on the Instagram or on the Twitter or on the Facebook page of the person that received it. So ultimately the customers are marketing the product for us. And every cameo we talk about is really the commercial for the next one.
Yeah. Who was the first celebrity you approached?
So Cassius Marsh, the person that made the first video, was Martin's client. We flew up the next weekend to Seattle, and I remember staying with him, and we were really nervous because we, even though Martin was his agent, like it was still like, very unclear if Cash would even appreciate the idea of getting paid for this, because this is something traditionally he had done for free on a one-off basis if people knew him and asked for him. And actually a crazy story. When we launched the site, only talent on the site when we first like launched it. So we built this website, we like figured out the payment processing and all this type of stuff. And I'll never forget, it was a Tuesday night, it was about 10 o'clock Pacific time. And we decided to have Cash tweet it out for the first time to his like 70,000 followers. We showed that original video and we said like, hey, if you want your own, you can pay $25 and get it on the site. Cassius had just invested in the company. He'd given us 25 grand to help like pay Devin and get this thing up and running. And when he sent the tweet out, I remember I was in Scottsdale, Arizona, trying to get some baseball players on. They were in Venice Beach, Devin, Cash, and Martin. And there were two dots on Google Analytics, one in Scottsdale and one in Venice. And nobody else came to the site. Like, it was crickets. And in fact, on Twitter, people started like talking to Cash and being like, hey, how much is this company paying you? He had just invested in the company. Like, you're really selling yourself out for $25. He wow. got like upset and like actually left. So literally, and then we're like, is Google Analytics working? I remember signing off the website and then we saw one doc go away and I came back out. It's like, nope, like literally nobody came to the website.
And then, well, clearly something clicked at some point.
And then, this is what was crazy. About 15 minutes later, you know, we're all arguing and on the phone. A dot pops up in Renton, Washington, which is actually the town where the Seattle Seahawks training facility is. And now it's like, okay, this is cool. Somebody's on the website. And today you go to Cameo and there's 10,000 talent and there's all these videos, reactions. There's a lot to do. when we launched, it was literally nothing except for a form to like book a video. There were no examples. There was nothing like, so this person's on the site for like 4 minutes and we have no idea like what he's doing.
Wow.
And then all of a sudden, like we're waiting, you know, we're at the edge of our seat. Like, are they going to buy? Are they going to buy? And then all of a sudden the dot just disappears. And we were so dejected. We felt absolutely terrible. Like, wow. And I had quit my job at LinkedIn at the time. It's like, I just left my great job to sell a product that nobody wants. Right. And we were so upset. And then all of a sudden I got a DM on Twitter and this dad goes, Cassius Marsh is my daughter's favorite player in the world. I would love nothing more than to get a video from him, but your payment processor is not working. So I just said, okay, you tell me what you want. We'll make sure the video's there. It was a Tuesday night. Her video was on Thursday. Of course, Cassius was mad at us and wasn't responding to our text messages. So we didn't get the video done till like Saturday, like a few days after the like. Actually, like you could tell he was doing us a favor. He wasn't into it. It was like so low energy in my opinion. Cause like I've seen him on and it was just like, he's just like, whatever, I'll do this. And he didn't even like do a good job. And then like a day later, I get a DM on Twitter and the dad had filmed his daughter's reaction to this video and did like a screen by screen. And I can share that with you guys after this. And literally the girl started crying.
Aww.
And it was she literally like is freaking out and she's like, Dad, how did you do this? You know, like, and it was magic.
That's the response everybody has is, where did this come from? How did you do it? So brag a little bit. How big is Cameo now, just a couple of years later?
Today we now have 10,000 talent on the platform. We've done over 200,000 of these cameos. The team is now over 70 people spread out between Chicago, where we're headquartered, Los Angeles, which is our co-headquarters. And then we've even got a couple people in Argentina and in London. We have one in Australia now. So, it's kind of all over the place.
What's the split with the celebrity? How does that work? And who decides how much a celebrity's worth?
Every talent sets their own price. So it's a 75-25 split talent's way. At this point, we now have 10,000 data points. So we're almost like a real estate company where, you know, if you guys came on, I could be like, well, here's some other podcasts. Here's how they're pricing themselves. This is what we think is good.
Wow. I wonder what we'd be worth.
But the early days, we actually created a formula that helped them price themselves. So we told, especially when we were dealing with athletes, like their salaries are publicly available. So we would say, you know, imagine if you make $25 million a year, like someone like Antonio Brown is that's on the platform. We would tell them, take $25 million divided by 2,000 hours in a work year, 50, 40-hour weeks. Divide that by 60, how many hours, minutes in an hour, you're actually making $208 per minute playing in the NFL on a max salary. So if you can do two of these per minute on the Cameo app and you charge $100 or you charge $200, you're making the same amount or more money per minute than you are playing in the NFL, which is a pretty great value prop because you're already getting paid that in the NFL.
Yeah.
So for us, like,
and you don't have to feel like a freight train just hits you when you're done with it.
Yeah, well, not only that, but like it's cheaper for the parent to get for their kid than buying tickets to the game, right? So,
yeah.
So the value prop was there. Even though the prices seem like they're low, we don't tell talent to optimize for how much they can charge. We tell them to optimize for a price that is affordable so they can do as many of these as they want to do. You could imagine if they were free, everybody would be requesting so much that there's actually no fulfillment. And then you just have Instagram DM.
Right, right. Who's the craziest person on there, like in your opinion, who's consistently good and like constantly evolving in the way they do their videos?
Andy Dick's amazing. Like that's one that, you know, I think is always so interesting. Like when you watch those videos, you never know what's going to happen. Perez Hilton has been like one of the early superstars for us on the platform. There's others like Andy Milonakis and Norm Macdonald. In general, I think like our comedians are some of the most interesting ones. But then like our Real Housewives especially do an incredible job. And you never know where they're going to pop up. Sometimes they'll be wine tasting or like at the dinner table or like in bed. Like you never know. And that's why these reality stars have done pretty great.
Do you guys screen the videos before they go out to the customer?
No, we don't. you know, we're really the marketplace here. So functionally, what happens when the video request comes in, we don't screen like what gets requested. At this point, we've created some safety features. So like if there's like there's certain keywords and terms that if they appear in the request, we can flag it and our team can look at it to make sure it's not like an inappropriate request or anything.
Sure.
But in most cases, it's going directly to the talent. The talent can accept or decline any request. They do the video, they put it in their own words, and then they go from there.
Interesting. All right, so Stephen, I know we need to wrap up, but what's your big takeaway from your last couple of years and you know, this idea that oddly started on your way out of your grandmother's funeral? What's the big business takeaway for people who have an idea?
Number one, you just have to get started, right? Like in the early days, if you see something before anyone else does, like you just have to go for it. And you also have to kind of burn the boats. There was about 3 months where I was still working at LinkedIn, trying to moonlight doing this. And I'll never forget my buddy Will Hearn. We were in Nicaragua and sitting in a hot tub on New Year's Day. And he goes, "Stephen, this is a big idea. If somebody else builds this company and becomes a billionaire and you're still working at LinkedIn, like, could you live with yourself?" And nobody had asked me that, but the answer was so obviously no. I never went back to work. And you know, I would encourage any young entrepreneur, if you have your idea, burn the boats, go for it. If you don't have conviction enough to quit your job or to put it all on the line, like nobody else is going to believe in you enough to invest. And if you have a great idea and you think you can do it while working your job, there is another entrepreneur somewhere else in the world that you don't know working on the same thing. And if you're not putting 110% of you, your mind, your body, your soul, like that becomes your company. This is the only thing you'll ever see me wear anywhere. You know, at the end of the day, like if you don't have conviction in yourself, nobody else is going to have conviction in you and your business.
Well, I'm pretty sure Cash is happy with you now at this point because it's certainly gone well. What's a great way for people to keep up with Cameo?
Yeah, go check us out on cameo.com. We're at Cameo on Instagram. We are at Book Cameo on Twitter. We're constantly showing off the new talent we're getting. Every day we add over 60 to 70 talent. So, you know, check in early, check in often. We highlight all the new talent we've done that week, you know, in a bar right on the main page. But check it out, buy one and get on our mailing list.
All right. Well, you know, we're available. Just kidding. All right, Stephen, thanks so much. We appreciate it and best of luck.
Thank you guys so much for having me.
You bet.
Okay, so say in theory, if I wanted to like have Debbie Gibson do a cameo for like my dad or something,
yeah,
would I be able to do that?
Well, you can and you can't. So here's what she does. When she has time in her schedule, she puts herself out on the website and she's available for a while. So she kind of goes on and off of Cameo, which I think a lot of the celebrities do depending on what they've got going on. Makes sense, right?
Yeah.
What you could do is you could get your dad some tickets to go see her in concert.
That's true.
That's all coming up. All you got to do is Google New Kids Mixtape Tour and you will find all the different concert dates. They're literally playing every big city across the country, and it goes for basically the summer through the end of July.
Nice.
And if you can, try to get onto that bus with Tiffany and Salt and Pepper, because I guarantee that's where the party is.
That sounds like a good time.
Thanks so much for listening to This Dying to Ask. You can keep up with us on Instagram. You will find me and Run Reed Sip. You'll find the show at Dying to Ask Podcast. And Jeff, where do we find you on Instagram?
Producer Jeff.
Awesome. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.
Bye.